Okay, welcome back, everyone. Good evening. We've been discussing over the last couple of weeks the change of century as we enter into the 1900s, and been discussing the World Zionist Congress as it was founded by Herzl, of course. And we were discussing the first Aliyah, which is unrelated to Herzl, as the 25,000 or so Jews moved from various locations to the land of Palestine even before he began his political movement. And what I'd like to do tonight is really just tie up a few issues regarding the World Zionist Congress, a few other ideas, which will lead us into the First World War, where I hope next week we'll be able to pick up with in the continuing development of leading up to, of course, the modern state of Israel. So let's just begin with some of those ideas. The Zionist movement, working now from our sheets. The Zionist movement, of course, has been fueled by many conflicting forces. When I say conflicting, this is some of the ideas that we've been speaking about I think we're all familiar that in the world of Jews. So Jews don't always see things the same way. I know it's hard to believe, but it's possible that two, three, four Jews can be involved in a certain endeavor, and everyone has a different understanding, a different perspective, a different goal in mind. And certainly in matters as big as the creation of the state and the birth of the Zionist movement as a political movement, there were many different forces that we've been discussing that were really at work, at play, during this time in the same umbrella organization. So, for example, there were some, Herzl amongst them, who viewed Zionism as a practical solution to anti-Semitism. Herzl, as we discussed at length, witnessed the Dreyfus trial, saw the problems that were afflicting the Jewish world, and said, I have a solution to this problem. If we would only have a state that would be like all other states, if we could have a country like all other countries, that would solve our problem. And so his idea of the political Zionist movement of creating a state is, we need a home for the Jews. Now, he believed that the type of Jew that would actually come to such a home was the poor, the destitute, those who couldn't make it in Europe, the Nebuchs of Europe that were in fact the source of the scorn and the ridicule of the powers that be, the nations of the world in enlightened Western Europe. He saw those Nebuch Jews, they're the ones who are going to come to his new country and will get them out. And what will be left will be the wealthy upper class. He didn't really envision that they would necessarily be so quick to move to his new land. But that was an entire group, which again he was the leader of, that saw the movement as a solution to a problem, a solution of anti-Semitism. Then we had, of course, those who had religious dreams of returning to the ancient homeland, and that was a religious fervor. Some were, as we mentioned in the past, messianic in nature. Others were less messianic, but just seeing it as a religious endeavor. And though those were two strange bedfellows, Herzl, who saw this as a practical solution to a problem, very secular, most of the group that he was affiliated with, anti-religious. But once you created an idea, a dream of returning to the homeland, many religious Jews jumped on board and saw this as a religious endeavor, of course, of the fulfillment of a lifelong ancient dream of returning to the homeland. These Jews were mostly Eastern European, and they were, in the early days, referred to as the Democratic Faction. That was certainly the English translation of the name that they took upon themselves. And they saw this not just to become a state where we would gather in Jews, but that this was going to be the fulfillment of the Jew, was going to create a new type of state that was going to take our place as the light unto the nations. It was going to be a very Jewish place. And then you had a third group of Jews who were really just running from persecution. They were not interested. Herzl had this was an ideal, a philosophical solution to anti-Semitism. There were other Jews who were simply running for their lives. They could care less about what it was going to look like in the philosophical debate between setting it up. They just needed a place to go. And all of these various groups, plus other different gradations amongst them, joined together under this one banner called Zionism. And Herzl's greatness was in being a figure who was so strong and powerful and unifying that we'll see how long he could hold on to this for. But in the early years, united many different factions with many different goals and dreams and visions as to what this should actually be under the banner of Zionism. And I know I've said this before, but you can't stress it enough what an awesome endeavor this was in the early 1900s, late 1800s, early 1900s, as he starts with this dream of Zionism. And it's really, it's just so symbolic of all these different Jews from very different camps, some very religious, some anti-religious, for different reasons, hearing the call of Zionism, of this return, of coming home, and so many different stripes coming together to join in this movement. So Herzl, again, his greatness was in being that unifying force. I've mentioned this many times before. Most in the religious world could not fathom that he would be the person unifying the Jews together to return home. It was such an anomaly of this irreligious, anti-religious person being that figure, but he was. And let's learn a little bit more about how things developed in these early years. Let's just talk a little bit about the World Zionist Congress. So he, of course, founds this movement in Basel in Switzerland in 1897. That first year, 200 participants came. Now, in the scheme of things, that's a number that's both very large and very small. Obviously, when you think about world Jewry, European Jewry in that time, and 200 people came, you say that's nothing. It's also at the same time, you say it's quite an accomplishment for the first year. You got 200 people to travel. This wasn't just get on a Zoom call for an hour. This is 200 people travel to Basel, Switzerland, from wherever they were coming from, to participate in this inaugural Zionist Congress. That first year, they established a very clear political agenda. We've spoken about in the past. Again, there are different types of agenda within Zionism, which we'll get to again a little bit tonight as well. It was a political agenda, and that means it was called the Basel Program of Zionism, which is a program to attract publicity and a publicly recognized, legally secured homeland in Palestine. We need a homeland. When I say political Zionism, was establish a place that would be a home to the Jewish people. Originally, it was, of course, in Palestine, which we'll talk later this evening, how that shifted and the significance of that event, where there was an idea floated to actually shift it. But, of course, the original idea was to go back to Palestine. Herzl very famously wrote in his diary that were I to sum up the Basel Congress in a word, which I shall guard against pronouncing publicly, he said, but if I had to summarize what we did during this first Congress, it would be, at Basel, I founded the Jewish state. It happened. That's when it began. Of course, it actually formalizes about 50 years later. The second Congress in 1898, the following year, had 400 participants. So they doubled the number of participants. We'll see Reb Chaim Weizmann is a first-time participant in the second Congress. So amongst these 200 new participants, we double the number from 200 to 400. The Congress met every year until 1901. So for the first 5 years of its existence, it met yearly. And then it began to meet every other year. So after 1901, it meets again in 1903, 05, 07, all the way to 1913, during which it takes a pause for the First World War. Those of us now, obviously all of us, I should say, experiencing the pandemic and things which happened every year are on hold. It's nothing new. There are many world events that have happened throughout world history which put things on hold, and this was one of them, in which this World Congress, the World Jewish Congress, which had already taken and gained some steam from 1897 all the way to 1913, and it takes a pause during the First World War, meets up again in 1921, and then again every other year from 1921 to 1931, 1939, of course, from 21 to 39, and then, of course, World War II puts an end to the meeting of the World Congress. It meets again in 1946, back in the place where it started, back in Switzerland, and traveled during those years in all different cities throughout Europe. It was in London, in Vienna, in Zurich, in Hamburg, in Prague, and several other cities during its roaming through Europe. And then, obviously, between 1946, post-World War II, and the next time it meets in 1951, obviously is the major event which we're all leading up to, the birth of the modern state of Israel in 1948. And so the first time that it meets post-1948, it meets, of course, in Yerushalayim, and that becomes the place in which it has met every year since in Yerushalayim, and it meets every four to five years. The first time that it met in Yerushalayim in 1951, the opening ceremony was at Herzl's grave. The Israeli government had moved Herzl's remains from Vienna, where he had been buried, where he died in the early 1900s, right, I think it was 1907, if I remember correctly. And they moved his remains to Mount Herzl, of course, in Yerushalayim. And the opening ceremony of the 1951 World Jewish Congress in Yerushalayim was at his graveside. And at that Congress in 1951, they established the Jerusalem Program, in which they replaced the Palestine Program of the early days, the first Congress in which the goal was to establish a state. Now it placed, of course, its main focus on the newly created state. We did it. So what do we do when Jews went to, so do we just disband and say we succeeded? No, of course not. We just shifted what the goal was. It was no longer to create the state, but it was to unify the Jewish people within the state, bring them to the state, and continue, obviously, development. Doesn't need to be stated that in 1951, the modern state of Israel needed a lot of help in its infancy. And so the World Jewish Congress simply shifted its focus. Those of you who might be familiar with this, because just last year, in early January of 2020, before the pandemic, was the 38th World Jewish Congress. You may have gotten, oh, I don't know, maybe 3,500 emails about registering to vote and to voting for your delegate. This was a major campaign because it is a major organization that has major funds that are decided upon by the delegates how they should be spent in Israel and elsewhere. Today, again, last year in 2020, there were over 500 elected delegates, thousands of participants from over 35 countries gather in Yerushalayim. And just an interesting point in terms of how it breaks down, those 500 delegates, 38% of them are from Israel, 29% of them are from the U.S. alone, and 33 come from the rest of the diaspora. So Mizrahi Canada, for example, which is an organization here out of Canada, is trying to get one of the, whatever the exact number is, the 33% out of the 500, 100 or so delegates that come from the entire diaspora. So the Canadian Jewish community votes on which delegate from which party they want to represent them. Just as an example, in the U.S., which is election-based, in Israel, it goes based on the actual Knesset elections. Different parties get different numbers of delegates out of the 38% of the World Zionist Congress delegates, which come in, are based on the actual elections. In the U.S. and in Canada, there are actual, not political elections, there are elections in which we vote for the delegates of the World Zionist Congress. In the U.S., just as an example, out of their delegates, 39 of their delegates are from the Reform Movement. Mizrahi has 27, the Haredi camps have 25, and Conservative Judaism 18. And I'm sure those who are interested can do studies over the years how that's moved or shifted in terms of various numbers of representation. And there's a lot of money at stake that the delegates give out and determine where it should be allocated. And therefore, there's a lot of talk, if you remember again, from a year ago, it seems like it was a decade ago before the pandemic, for voting for various parties in order to have voices within Judaism recognized on the World Zionist Congress. Okay, there's some interesting points on the Congress. What happened in about the Uganda proposition, which is an important landmark in the World Zionist Congress history, was, as we spoke about this in the past, Herzl had a great difficulty gaining traction. Jews were interested, because, of course, the Jews wanted a state for themselves. The problem was, if you're going to have a state for yourself, and again, Herzl believed in political Zionism, which means getting permission from the nations of the world for it. It's nice that the Jews were gaining traction, but the problem is we got to get the nations of the world to give us the land, to give us permission, because, again, that's political Zionism. And he was finding it very difficult. He was not being very successful. He had failed meetings. He came to the land of Palestine and to speak to the Ottomans, and that, of course, went nowhere. Turkey, Germany, he was unsuccessful. So eventually makes his way to England, hoping to gain some positive traction there. And he met with Lord Rothschild and with Joseph Chamberlain. Joseph Chamberlain was the colonial secretary of England at the time. And it's unclear exactly at which point this idea was germinated. that the Jews should be given a plot of land in British East African colony of Uganda, and the British government would support the Jews taking over that particular piece of land. Now, by definition, England didn't offer that to the Jews because they loved us. They offered it because they had an ulterior motive, which was it was self-serving. What was the self-serving idea that England wanted to give Uganda to Herzl to colonize as the state for the Jews? They were involved with Germany at the time for control of Africa. And part of Uganda was under English control. The Germans were laying claim to it. And in order to stake their claim, it was like almost like a wild idea and some meaning that says, I don't know, why don't we give you Uganda? It didn't like work its way through the entire English government. It was an idea. But Herzl grabbed hold of it and said, that is a brilliant idea that we should go, because what's going to happen is from a practical perspective, you get money, the British will support you, the army and the navy are there because it's now of British interest, and you'll have the support that you need. What a brilliant way of solving so many different problems. Again, if your main problem is, we have an anti-Semitic problem, we need to have a state of our own, we need funding, we need protection, this solves all of the problems. And who cares that it's not in Palestine? Okay, ideally we started it in Palestine. But if we can't work it out in Palestine, we'll work it out somewhere else. If you remember the letter that Herzl wrote to, I'm blanking on his name, the Arab leader, the governor of Yerushalayim, when we spoke about this last week, wrote the letter to the chief rabbi in France and said, leave us alone, the Arabs aren't going without a fight. And Herzl wrote back, okay, if you don't want us, we'll find somewhere else. So he did. He found somewhere else. So he was all over this idea, and he said, we, the Jews, when we take over this land in Africa, he was correct about this. He knew we would succeed in developing it, agriculture, technology, whatever, we would make it work. And then we'd become the crown jewel in the crown of England. They would say, look at what the Jews did. This would solve all of our problems. And once we're successful, everybody will love us. Now, he was right that we would succeed. He was wrong that our success will lead anyone to think highly of us. That has proven itself not correct over the last 100 years. But therefore, he saw this as a brilliant solution to the problem. So in 1903... he proposes this at the World Jewish Congress. This is the 6th World Jewish Congress in 1903, and he proposes this as a plan. And it, in effect, just splits the convention in half. And when Jews are split in half, it wasn't like polite and kind and, oh, I see your way. It was, this is either the worst idea ever, it's a disaster, or this is something that we have to absolutely pursue. Why did it split them in half? Well, it split them in half because of the reasons that we had said, that really this umbrella that he had created, and credit to him for doing so, was filled with many different Jews with many different dreams and visions of what was being accomplished. This, and it's the case, it's such a great example of so many different things in life. Many times, any organization, be it a school, a shul, or anything else for that matter, can be filled with different people who feel differently about very many important things. But it's not a problem that they get together, because it never comes to the forefront where those differences of opinions force the issue to a head. And you have to make a very major decision because of that. So, okay, there was this umbrella organization called Zionism. And some Jews thought it was a messianic. And some Jews thought it was religious. And some Jews thought it was just to avoid persecution. And some Jews hated religion. And they all sat together in the Congress. And they had enough things common amongst them that they managed to make that work for 6-7 years, in which we're going to raise money together, we're going to politically be active together, we're going to get our land. There was a common goal that held them together. This suggestion of let's go to Uganda was that watershed moment that reveals everybody's true colors. And once that genie is out, you can't ever put it back in again. Because this feeling of the religious Eastern European Jews who said, this is a religious movement. This is Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, the land that was promised to our forefathers that we've been dreaming about for 2,000 years. Uganda? What are you talking about? It wasn't just like, oh, you like vanilla, I like chocolate. That's impossible. And to Herzl, it wasn't impossible. It's going to solve the problem that I originally had from the very beginning. So the opposition to this idea was led by Chaim Weizmann, and he was of the Democratic faction, as I had mentioned earlier. Chaim Weizmann was born in the Pale of Settlement in Russia in 1874 and received a very traditional Jewish education from religious parents. He eventually makes his way to Berlin, where he becomes a chemist. He was clearly a very, very bright individual. And at some point becomes, again, remember his lifespan is from 74 to 52. So in 74, we're in, when he was 6 years old, the first Aliyah begins. So it's already the movement back, the Chovav Etzin already has existed. And by the time he's a 20-year-old, 25, Herzl's already begun his Zionist Congress. So he's right in that, he's growing up in that fervor of this return, this concept of Zionism. And he graduates Berlin as a chemist, becomes an ardent Zionist, and eventually dedicates his entire life to this cause. Of course, as you know, becoming the first president in 48. After he missed the first Congress, he is invited to participate as a delegate already. He was not able to go. But from the second and on, he went to all of them. Very astute politician. He was a great organizer, a fine speaker with a strong personality. And he was the counterforce to the Western assimilated Zionism, which Herzl himself represented, a very westernized assimilated Jew. And Weizmann represented a more religious approach. He himself personally, over the course of his lifetime, vacillated between being more observant and less observant. He eventually, I believe, if I have this fact straight, died a very observant Jew. His own life was trying to navigate the modern world with his religious upbringing and trying to find that balance. Either way, he represented a more traditional Jewish approach of what the return to Zion should look like. And the idea of Uganda flies in the face of everything, which is why it was such a watershed moment. Because this displayed Herzl's misunderstanding of the different factions within his movement. And he was taken aback by the vehement revolt of the opposition. It wasn't just an idea that they opposed. It was this, they revolted against it. He reportedly got up and threatened that he took it so personally, said, if this move doesn't pass, I'm leaving the Zionist movement. He threatens to leave. They're threatening to leave. That brought about many of the middle-of-the-road delegates who maybe weren't so sure about going to Uganda, but the thought of losing Herzl was enough to join them onto his side. And it was clear for close enough, and it was such a vicious fight, they decided to table it in 1903, and they were going to sit on it for a year, debate it, and would vote on it the following Congress in 1904. So that when that Congress ended, it ended with the proposition of going to Uganda was an item on the agenda. That was going to be the item to vote on the following year. Will we take the British up on their offer to go to Uganda, or are we going to reject it? Now remember, of course, in hindsight, it's like easy to see. In 1905, there was not a reason in the world to believe that getting a state in Palestine was anywhere in the near future, which of course it actually wasn't. It was 40 years away. So the two sides were, and again, it's so easy to look back in hindsight, it's great to try to put yourself in the shoes of a delegate in 1904 when you're given an opportunity for a state. You're given an opportunity. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. You're given, it's 1904, and you're literally given an opportunity for a state. Everything you've dreamed of for the last 7 years. 7 years, you've been going to these Zionist congresses, you've been doing all that you've been doing, trying to fundraising, and now you have an opportunity, but it's in Uganda. And the other option is, who knows? The other option is, nothing clear. There's no plan. Even if someone would have told you it's going to take 40 years, that would have been but we don't even know that at the time. And this therefore brought out the two different factions. Those who said, I don't care what's going on, we're not going to Uganda, versus those who said, let's do this. Eventually, so again, as I mentioned, they tabled it for the following year in 1904. And as divine providence would have it, for whatever reasons, between that time of 1903 and 1904, Herzl takes sick, and he does not even survive to 1904. He dies in between. By the time the next Congress meets, that idea, England itself wasn't so clear that they were ever actually intending on doing it. And without Herzl's leadership, the whole idea falls apart. And at that point, as we'll get to in a moment, for the first time, Herzl is very personally attacked and criticized within Zionist circles. Meaning, for the first couple of years, he was Herzl. And he was the force behind all of this. And that leads to the real significance of why the proposition is historically significant. One might think, like, it never happened. So, like, what's the big deal? It was a very big deal in defining the battle lines within the factions, within the Zionist movement. As we said, the Jews have different approaches. And this, you couldn't hide anymore where a person stood and what the agenda was of the movement. And it opened Herzl up to serious criticism and attack for having suggested that this is really where we should be going to Uganda. And as I mentioned before, once that genie was out, it was sort of out. And it reflected that Herzl's vision was a state for Jews, but not to the land of the Jews. He wasn't committed to the land of the Jews. He was committed to having a state for Jews. And all those who had joined in because they were committed to the land found as it was, his vision wasn't for them, but they were still within it, so it became a struggle to take over the movement. The successor of Herzl, is a fellow named Max Nordau, who is also a Western assimilated Jew, but the group led by Weizmann became a very, very powerful element through this. And the army of Schnurs, as Herzl had not so pleasantly referred to them, really took over a very significant control over the movement in the aftermath of this entire proposition. I want to just share one quote from Weizmann's biography, Trial and Error. He writes about this time as follows. He says, "We were not revolutionaries." Describing his faction of the group of the Zionist movement. "We were a struggling group of young academics without power and without outside support. But we had a definite outlook on life," he says. "We were young, we were academia, but we had nothing, but we had an outlook. And we did not like the note of eloquence and pseudo-worldliness which characterized official Zionism." Remember that this Western secularized faction of Herzl, remember he made everybody wear a top hat and dress formal. He wanted it to be German. It was a very big part of the way that he ran it. So Weizmann, representing the Eastern European segment, who didn't have any of that formality, the aristocratic nature of the Western assimilated Jew, they saw the notes of eloquence and pseudo-worldliness and said, "We don't like the dress suits and the frock coats and the fashionable dresses of the West. It's missing the point." "The formalism of the Zionist Congress made a painful impression upon me," Weizmann wrote, "especially after my visits to the wretched and oppressed Russian Jewish masses. I've been in Eastern Europe. I watched what's going on in the shtetl, in Russia, in Lithuania. What are they doing in their top hats?" He says, "Actually, it was all very modest, but it smacked us of being artificial and extravagant. That whole element didn't speak to them. It did not speak to us of the democracy, the simplicity, the earnestness of the Jewish people. We were uncomfortable with it." So you had, again, all of these just different ideas struggling for the power and leadership of the Zionist movement. The other major issue, second one, besides for the what the Uganda propaganda brought out, was what's known as a culture clash. Now, a culture clash is really just a euphemism for religion. Besides for the idea of should it be Israel, should it be Palestine, or should it be somewhere else, anywhere else, is what should the culture of this state that we're creating be? And this, again, has been a theme that we've traced really throughout. And if you haven't noticed, it still exists until today. It is the theme of what should the Jewish state look like. And the first four Congresses adopted resolutions specifically to stay neutral on this issue. They adopted resolutions in the first 4 years, in 97, 98, in 1900, in 1901. that we're going to be neutral in all matters of Jewish culture, meaning Zionism will never do anything against the Jewish religion, but it will never do anything for the Jewish religion. Our goal is to create a state, and they're pretending as if this religious debate didn't exist. They were not interested in defining a Jewish state. This is going to be a state for the Jews, so that we have a place to go. Herzl was aware of the different voices within the movement and wanted to avoid it, and it was very purposely and officially avoided. And this issue cannot be avoided. If you try to avoid any issue with Jews that feel strongly about something, we know how that's going to go. And it has continued, literally, until today, the struggle for what will define the nature of the modern state of Israel. The Russian Jews, the Eastern Jews, very much opposed and objected this idea of resolutions that were purposely remaining neutral and avoiding the issue of what should the religious flavor look. They were dreaming of a utopian state. They wanted to become a light unto the nations. They wanted to restore the Messianic. It has to be infused with Jewish culture, which meant religious and traditional Jewish values. So you have Herzl trying to keep it neutral. You have the voices, I will call it the right, saying, neutral? This is a Jewish state. We're coming home. We've been praying and davening for this for thousands of years. Of course it's going to be a religious place. And then you have, on the left, the Haskalah, the socialist Marxists, who we've been discussing in previous weeks as well, who had a completely different definition of the religious Jews. And when they think religion, of course, is the opiate of the masses. And when you talk about Jewish culture, so this is Echad Ha'am. Yes, it's going to be a Jewish culture. It's just not a religious culture. We need to leave aside the shtetl and all of the caricatures of what the shtetl life is and modernize in a Jewish way, Jewish culture into this land of Israel. So you have neutrality, you have religious, you have Jewish, but not religious, and creating a new Jewish culture, all of them vying for the voice of what will become this modern state. And from the Fifth Congress and on, Jewish culture becomes an agenda item. It's something to be discussed. What should the culture be? And as you can imagine, and as you know from those of us, it's never been resolved. It continues to exist. Those of you following the news today, I'm sure have seen yesterday, terrible protests and riots in the Haredi world in the land of Israel. And this issue at its core is always, you know, religious Jews living in what is our homeland, but they're living under a government that's a secular government that's enacting all these laws. Now, these particular laws we all see and understand as is in their own best interest. It's to protect them and protect those around them. But it's in the, and again, this is not a class I'm trying to understand the Haredi perspective, but at least it's just worthwhile one line of, in their world, there's a foreign secular government telling them what to do in the land of Israel. Can't tell us what to do here. And despite the fact that all, you know, rational approaches to how you live in a foreign, like, this is your government, these are the rules, but it's at the core of, you can't tell us. It just doesn't work that way. And everyone's saying, yes, it does. And you end up with riots in the street, and it's just terrible on all sides. This has never been resolved until today. It still goes on. All the issues between Haredi, secular, there are different reasons which drive them all, but it all is this fight over what's going on in this land, and can a secular person tell a religious person what should be or what shouldn't be? And can a religious person impose their will on a secular Jew within the land? And welcome to the complications of the modern state of Israel. And as I think I joked, if it was last week, when Mashiach comes, they'll figure all this out and solve all the problems for us. It's not simple at all. Let's move to Hebrew, the language of Hebrew. Fascinating, fascinating part of these early days. Herzl proposed French as the natural language, of the new state of the Jews, and later thought it should be German. Now, if you ask about Hebrew didn't exist as an option. It wasn't something that he thought about and rejected. It just wasn't who was speaking Hebrew in 1897 that should have been an option. But a modern state needed a modern language, which is why he, of course, thought it should either be French or German. The Eastern European Zionists, of course, pushed strongly for Yiddish. Yiddish is such a Jewish language. It has so much history, so much culture, so much Jewish wisdom in the language. That's obviously the language that should become the national language of the homeland. Now, the fact that it would have excluded a million Sephardic-speaking Jews who don't speak a word of Yiddish didn't seem to bother them at all. But that should have been, so you have German, you have French, you have Yiddish. What's going to be the language? And in literally a divine stroke of Hashem, like just establishing the way that this is going to go, there's a Jew by the name of Eliezer ben Yehuda. His real name was Perlman. Eliezer Yitzchak Perlman was his name. He's born in 1858, dies a relatively young man. He's 64 years old in 1922. And he is born into a very religious family, and in Eastern Europe, and he's educated in the traditional cheder. He is an expert in Gemara. He's clearly a brilliant fellow. That goes without saying. And he's sent off to yeshiva with the hopes of becoming, a Talmudic scholar. He is there exposed to the enlightened secular writings, some of which are in Hebrew, and, veers away from the path of a traditional scholarship that his family, I'm sure, dreamed of. He eventually learns French and German and Russian. He's attending university in Paris, and he becomes exposed to, again, some Hebrew writing, meaning articles written in Hebrew had been a language that had been written in rabbinic language, in rabbinic scholarship forever. Letters and responsa had been written in Hebrew. Svarim, Jewish books, Jewish thoughts had always been written in Hebrew, but as a spoken language, very, very infrequent. And in one of the books, one of the biographies of Ben Yehuda, record that while in Paris in 1880, right after he finishes university, he has a chance meeting with a Jew, a Jerusalemite Jew who had also shown up in Paris, and they were able to have a conversation together in Hebrew. And that's his epiphany moment, in which he comes to the clear conclusion, this is again 1880, this is 17 years before Herzl will establish the first Zionist Congress. We're in the beginning, first Aliyah begins in 1880 till the beginning, like around 1900, that 20-year period. So this is before, again, Chovav Etzion, there's a trickle of Jews that are coming back. He has this idea in 1880 that the way to unify all of the Jews wherever in the four corners of the earth that they have been scattered to is Hebrew. They all speak different languages. But look, I met a Jew from Jerusalem. I'm from Eastern Europe. I'm educating myself now in Paris. I run into a Jew from Jerusalem. We can talk to each other in Hebrew. That's the key. That's the key to reuniting all the Jews from wherever they are. And he writes, quote, "The Hebrew language can live only if we revive the nation and return it to the fatherland." So he has this idea of what Herzl is going to come on to later, of if we get the Jews back to Israel, Palestine at the time, and we can revive the language, now we have this common factor. Now, the ancient language, Hebrew was an old language. The Chumash is written in Hebrew, the way that Hashem created the world, as Chazal tells us, from the language of Hebrew. But it was an ancient biblical language. It was not a spoken language. As anyone who studies language will tell you, language evolves. The way that people speak and the idioms and the slang and the new words, all these things, it's a dynamic concept, a language. And Hebrew had been a very biblical scholarly language. Again, I want to stress, it was always used. Jewish scholars have always studied in Hebrew, written response in Hebrew, written their novel, Chidushe Torah, were written in Hebrew. It was always used, but it wasn't a spoken language. And he, with this idea, says we need to modernize this language. He moves the following year, in 1881, to Palestine. Forms a committee, the Va'ad HaLashon, the Committee on Language, and gets to work modernizing the language of Hebrew. He writes a dictionary and uses, he writes, the Semitic languages, Aramaic, Arabic, various language to use the rules of grammar and how to conjugate and make up new words. Many of the words he made up stuck, some of them did not. But he revives that which was certainly always a written language into a spoken language. His son, Ben Zion Ben Yehuda, is raised entirely in Hebrew. He does not speak a word. And again, his biography, he chastised his wife, Eliezer Ben Yehuda, to chastise his wife for singing a Russian lullaby to their baby. He was Hebrew only, and he's believed to be the first native speaker of modern Hebrew as a mother tongue, where that was what he learned. That's the only language that he heard, was this modern language of Hebrew. There was quite a lot of opposition to what he was doing. Number one, the opposition came from the religious Jewish community. Many religious Jews understood Hebrew, of course, is referred to as Lashon HaKodesh. It's the holy tongue. The Ramban and the Rambam both comment, why is Hebrew, the language of the Chumash, why is it called Lashon HaKodesh? So they offer different reasons, whether or not a more mystical reason is that it's the language that Hashem used to create the world, it's the language Hashem speaks, it's the language that Vayomer Elokim Yehi Or, Vayehi Or, it is a holy language. It's a language unlike any other language, and many mystical components to that, which we're not getting into. Or, as the Rambam suggests, it's called the Lashon HaKodesh, the holy tongue, because there are certain words which you don't find. Certain inappropriate words are not found in the language. It is a clean, pure, holy language. Well, when you modernize it and you make it into a spoken language, there are some not such holy aspects to the language. So the religious community said, you're killing our language. You took that which was holy, that which we speak tefillah and learning Torah with, and you just took this language and you made it into a street language with slang and curse words and all sorts of inappropriate things. It was a terrible thing in many people's eyes. Even Herzl himself, when the idea came to him, thought the whole idea was ridiculous. It's never going to happen. We have German and French. Why would you create this new language for our people? Ben Yehuda, just through perseverance and through his brilliance, wrote one of the finest dictionaries of Hebrew. He lobbied, he traveled, he persevered, and he sold the idea to the masses. It's almost hard to imagine, like, how do you do that? How did you get people to start speaking a language, a new language? But from about the year 1909, Hebrew becomes the new language of the pioneers arriving in Israel. 1909 is in the middle of the second Aliyah, which we haven't really spoken about, which begins at about the year 1904 until the First World War, 1914. But in around 1909, the idea takes hold. Now, he's been in Palestine, Ben Yehuda, since 1881. So it took 20 years, almost 30 years of work, of effort, of defining. But the language takes hold, and today it is known as one of the only languages in the world that was born out of a previous language that had not been used, and it becomes the native speaking language of millions of people in a very short period of time. You think about 1909, it's 100 years ago. And it's the language spoken by millions of Israelis, and it has indeed become a unifying language of, those of us who are not such great Hebrew speakers, but if you learn Hebrew from the Siddur, from the Chumash a little bit, you make your way. You can go to our homeland and you find your way a little bit. But I could tell you from experience, if you come to a country that speaks a foreign language that you don't speak, you're lost. But a Jew who learns to daven and a little bit of Chumash, you can figure out, and it becomes the unifying language. But it is all Jews come and they learn Hebrew. And that's become the language, for better or for worse. I have no comment on it. It is. It is what happened. And Eliezer Ben Yehuda gets the credit for being able to do so. Cecil Roth wrote a book on Eliezer Ben Yehuda, which he called, Was Hebrew Ever Really a Dead Language? Meaning to say, like, Hebrew never was a dead language. It's not like Latin. It was used always. Every time we open up a Siddur and a Chumash, we're speaking in Hebrew. It never died. It just was never a spoken language. So he summarized Ben Yehuda's work by saying, before Ben Yehuda, Jews could speak Hebrew. After him, they did. very, very insightful line describing what he was able to accomplish. One last point for tonight, and which again we've spoken about before, and we're going to have to speak about it again. But let's just in this period in history is religious Zionism. So again, as Herzl begins his movement. And especially with the Uganda proposition, the different factions come to a head as to where the different values and ideals are. So religious Zionism takes a center stage as well as a component of it. Rabbi Yaakov Reins found the Mizrahi movement in the early 1900s. So a couple of years into the World Zionist Congress movement, he founds the Mizrahi organization to be a proponent of religious elements within Zionism. Now, he was the middle ground within the religious response to Zionism, because the religious response were on two very opposite sides of the spectrum. On the one hand, there were those, as we've spoken about, who view this as evil. This is clearly a secular movement. It has no religious component. They don't believe in God even. They don't believe in Torah. Everything they're doing is a sham, and it's an imposter, and we need to get rid of it. And there were that component of from the religious community. And then on the other side were those who believed that this was a messianic movement, and the fact that it was garbed in secular Jews who were leading it was irrelevant to them. Messiah is coming. He's here. We're returning to the land. So you had within the religious world those who felt Mashiach is coming and those who felt this was worse than Gehenna. Those are the two responses. And Rabbi Reins founds the Mizrahi, which at the time took that middle approach that said, there's a place for both. This is a wonderful solution to a problem of anti-Semitism. Just like Herzl believed this was a practical solution. Yes, this is a great practical solution. And it doesn't have to be like Herzl wants it, without any religious component, without any Jewish component. We should make it not just a state for Jews, we should make it a Jewish state. It can be both at the same time, a solution to a problem, a very practical thing, and let's make it Jewish. Doesn't have to be Mashiach is coming, doesn't have to be evil. Let's just infuse it with the Jewish flavor that has been our heritage for 2,000 years, 3,000 years. Let's just make it Jewish. It was a very popular approach amongst many Jews. The early Mizrahi movement had Jews, religious Jews from all different camps. Those who today would want nothing to do with the Mizrahi movement from the more right-wing camps. But in the early days, this was a wonderful approach to combine that which was going on. Eventually, of course, the Aguda movement gets started in Europe in 1913, I think is when the Aguda movement starts, and that becomes more representative of what's known as the yeshiva world. In the 30s and 40s, the main clash between Mizrahi and the Aguda come to a head as to whether or not supporting the actual creation of the state of Israel, now it's practical, it's here, should we support this or not, really was one of the things that separated. The Aguda was more opposed, the Mizrahi was more in favor, and things then, of course, have continued over the century from them. From 1904 to 1935, the religious flavor of the land was really represented by the battles between Rabbi Cook, the first chief rabbi of pre-state Israel of Palestine, Rami Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, and Rav Yosef Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, who was the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim. Rabbi Sonnenfeld was represented more of the traditional yeshiva, Eastern European Jewish approach. And Rav Cook, who we've spoken about in the past, and hopefully we'll get to again a little bit in the future, represented he had a messianic vision on life, but saw that the secular Jews who were bringing everybody back to the land of Israel and settling the land and farming the land and developing it needed to be partnered with. Take them for who they are right now and let's build them up and let's find common ground. Let's make them into religious Jews. Whereas the religious Jews of the time of Yerushalayim very much wanted nothing to do with the secular Jews who thought they were just going to ruin their way of life. And there's no, you know, it's no black and white, nothing simple. We can look back at it historically, but that aspect of religious Zionism is very much defined by we've had an entire class in the past on Rav Cook and Rav Sonnenfeld in terms of how their approaches to that first early days within the land of Palestine. Rav Cook dies in 1935. Very much define that, and then will define the future of religious Zionism as it continues, and after of Cook's death to the founding a few years later. But those are just a few thoughts to tie up the issue of the World Zionist Congress to some of the issues of the early days. Mirtz Hashem, next week, I hope we'll start getting ready for the background of the First World War, and then the impact, of course, that that has on the developing state leading into, again, getting to 1948. We're working our way closer and closer every week. Always a pleasure to have everybody on board, and look forward to getting together again next week.